This is your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss media coverage of the presidential election and what is at stake. Election Day is in just 17 days. Much of the coverage is consumed by Donald Trump's unhinged campaign and predictions of who will win the Electoral College. But who's really looking at the bigger picture and talking about what is at stake? Today we're joined by Will Bunch, an award-winning journalist and national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will has written a number of books on politics, including his most recent, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Hi, Will. Thanks for joining us again.
Yeah. Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for having me back on. I appreciate it.
Great to have you. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic, where he has covered politics and culture since 2015. Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's great to be back.
Well, great to have you both. Before we dive in and talk about how you're covering this race, what are your thoughts about major media? There's just so much happening so quickly. What really stands out for you when you look at the coverage across the board? Will, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, I think there's no doubt that what's become the existential question of 2024 when it comes to politics and the media is, you know, I mean, you mentioned in the intro, you know, how do we cover the increasingly, well, it's unhinged, but also dangerous, and probably the dangerous part is even more important, because what Trump has been talking about in the last couple of weeks, has clearly been a kind of an American fascism where you would see things like the military being sent into cities or being used for this mass deportation program that would involve camps. You know, he is directly echoing Adolf Hitler and other strong men when he talks about going after the enemy within. And, you know, for the media, particularly, you know, those wedded to, you know, giving straight down the middle news coverage of this campaign, how do you deal with something like that? How do you sound the alarm and yet people feel, you know, tied down by this 800-pound weight of convention that we don't have a history of dealing with a threat like this, and we should have developed the language to deal with it. And the language to deal with it does exist, but there's a fear, I think, in the media of using it. So I think that's really become the big question in the campaign's final days.
What are your thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with most of what Will said. I mean, I think that one of the challenges that the press has always had with Donald Trump is just that he's a dyed-in-the-wool yapper and loves to run his mouth, and in such a way, too, that I think there's always, and I think when you talk to, when you go to his rallies or you talk to his supporters, people will glom on to different things. The sort of age-old question of whether you should be taking Trump seriously or literally. And I think the press, I think contra some media critics, I think the press has always done a good job of taking him seriously. But I think what we have seen, particularly since about 2019, is a real concerted effort on behalf of him, both Trump and his allies, but also various intellectual figures on the right and some Republican politicians, most notably J.D. Vance and Tom Cotton, a little bit Josh Hawley too, try to start intellectually backfilling the kind of stuff that Trump yaps about. And I think what you've seen, as Will said, is a kind of blueprint for a form of American fascism. And I think that the media has generally been slow to catch up on this. And I think part of that is, I think, actually a quite defensible kind of conservative impulse and sort of mainstream organs to not get in over their skis, to not risk editorializing in a way that would even further damage what little credibility or sort of authenticity the media has right now. But I think that one of the things that's been, I think, frustrating for me at least, is also in the early stages of this campaign, the Harris campaign was, I think, a little reluctant to push some of these points. And I think, you know, their kind of working theory of this election is just that the electorate has moved to the right on a number of issues, most notably immigration. And so I think there was a kind of vacuum for a while of people who are taking this seriously. Now, I think, you know, over the last 2 weeks, the Harris campaign has done a considerably better job of of making that case, which I think has opened up space for the mainstream media to cover it a little bit more effectively.
You know, talking about the word fascist, I remember when Trump was first running and then won the Electoral College, you had some people using that word. I'll think of Jason Stanley. He's a Yale professor. I mean, he wrote a whole book about fascism, and we've had him on a number of times. But there was this debate. I mean, even the media debated, should we use the word lie? So there's always this debate, should we use this word? And years go by, and all of a sudden, you've got someone like General Milley, Mark Milley, who worked with Trump as his former joint chiefs, telling Bob Woodward that Donald Trump is a fascist to his core. This is what always happens, Will. There's a debate 5 years ago, and then all of a sudden you have mainstream people. You can't get more mainstream than General Mark Milley calling Trump a fascist. And then it gives people kind of an okay to use that word. So what are your thoughts on this, Will?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I've thought about a lot going back to 2015. And you know, I mean, it's an important debate, and it is complicated, I think, because, you know, the danger and the reason that people debate about using what you might call alarmist language. When I say alarmist, that doesn't mean it's bad necessarily. It could be sounding the alarm that needs to be sounded, like a four-alarm fire, right? You know, but the question about using that language, you know, one thing, you know, as Alex said, are you getting ahead of your skis? Are you going too far? You know, the other thing is, are you just turning people off? You know, I mean, we've had this debate for years, right, about comparing Trump or any other public figure to Hitler, right? And then this whole debate with Godwin's law, right, that once you invoke Adolf Hitler in an argument, you've lost the argument, you know? And I think that kind of guided the thinking about Trump and fascism, you know? And when you mentioned Mark Milley, I think it's so important because he's got to be one of the most respected people in American public life. And, you know, and for him to make that comment, it's interesting. Ever since that story about his comments to Bob Woodward was published, I've noticed there's been a noticeable uptick in people in the mainstream media willing to talk about Trump and fascism. You know, I mean, sometimes they quote Milley, but not always. I happened to catch a little bit of MSNBC's Morning Joe this morning, you know, and Mika Brzezinski was out there saying, you know, that we have to call what Trump is doing right now fascist, you know, and that's something they wouldn't have said on a show like Morning Joe 8 years ago. But, you know, it's taken so much. You're right. I mean, the signs were there in 2015, and people, I think a lot of people, and I think I tried to do this in some of my learning background. It's like, oh, it's not, you know, maybe it's not classic Mussolini fascism. It's like somebody called it in 2015 celebrity fascism, which I thought was an interesting term and whatever. But, you know, as Trump has fine-tuned his program and really, you know, fine-tuned his ideas about mass deportation or using the military on domestic soil, I mean, that is straight-up fascism. And I think it's good people are coming to reel it. The one last point I'll make quickly is, you know, the other part of the debate is, does using a word like fascism really make a difference, right? You know, is there some hypothetical voter out there who says, oh my gosh, when you know, you're right, Trump is a fascist, when you put it that way, I won't vote for him. You know, it doesn't seem like there's many voters at this point who are going to be greatly influenced by the language, which probably weighs into some of the media's calculations about using it.
Well, and according to Wikipedia, here's the definition of fascism: a far-right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology and movement characterized by a dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, and militarism. So to go back to why Mark Milley said this, he told Bob Woodward, no one has ever been as dangerous to this country as Donald Trump. I realize he's a total fascist. He's the most dangerous person in this country. According to MSNBC, he went on to note that he feared a possible court martial in a second Trump term, despite the fact that he's now a civilian. After all, according to Trump's former defense secretary, Mark Esper, Trump set out to have two retired military leaders, Stanley McChrystal and William McCraven, court-martialed for saying things about Trump that he didn't like. According to the Washington Post, Millie has received a nonstop barrage of death threats. And after he retired, he installed bulletproof glass and blast-proof curtains at his home. We should also add that in Mark Esper's book, he said during the George Floyd uprising, Trump asked, can't we just shoot protesters? So the words are important, but also what he says he will do and what he has done is just as important. Alex, what are your thoughts on that? I sometimes feel like when I hear media coverage, it's almost like the guy has not been in office for 4 years and has not done so many things and has so much damage to this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that's tricky about the fascism debate is that people have this idea of, you know, jackbooted brown shirts as being this kind of fascist system. And like, if you look at Italy, right, the constitutional system was still intact. The king was still there. Like Antonio Gramsci was elected, you know, as a communist to the parliament after Mussolini came to power. You know, in terms of Germany, you know, you look at Nazi Germany, you look at movies that present the Gestapo as being this kind of all powerful force. There were like 200 of these guys per state, you know, like in general, that system was, I think, much less omnipresent. And that, I think, is the thing that makes it alarming, right, is that actually the reality, I think, is much closer than we would like. At the same time, I think that one of the issues that the Democrats have been running into is, you know, this idea that voters are looking at the Trump era with rose-tinted glasses, that essentially the authoritarian attacks on him aren't working because voters look back at those years, and one, they just completely erase the period from February 2020 until, you know, right around January 6th, 2021. But also that they see them as a period of prosperity and comparable safety with regard to, you know, the sort of the wave of undocumented immigrants that have come, asylum seekers since 2021. And I think that the Harris campaign has really struggled with those two issues. And you know, I think that the fascism argument, I think, is more legitimate than some people do. But I also think that one of the issues that Democrats have had a hard time with is reminding voters, one, just of the kind of teeth grinding anxiety of day to day life that was. But I think also too that, you know, that Trump, the success of Trump's political program, to the extent that it existed at all, was of a merger of a lot of things that voters don't like about Republicans. It, you know, his only real legislative accomplishment was a massive corporate tax cut that was heavily skewed towards top earners. People at the bottom of the income bracket got basically nothing from that. And in general, you know, his foreign policy, right? This has been another thing that Trump has argued, that essentially America needs a strong man, that Vladimir Putin wouldn't have invaded Ukraine, that somehow he would, you know, I don't know, he would both be encouraging Israel to do more and less simultaneously. You know, it's all ridiculous, right? Like John Bolton was one of his chief military advisors. And even though Bolton and Trump have fallen out, this is still someone who's surrounded by people with neoconservative impulses, right? The prospect of going to war with Iran, already high at the moment, I think would increase exponentially if you were to return to the White House.
Well, yeah. And then just quickly, I have to talk about family separation. Well, that's not hardly talked about. And then the lies during COVID and rolling back so many environmental laws. I mean, there's just so much. And if he comes back to power, we've been doing a series on Project 2025. And our guests say that the second Trump term will be far worse because they have a plan in place this time. He's going to surround himself with MAGA yes men. They're not going to stand up to him like Millie and others did this time around. So what about that, Will? That's also, we don't even talk about COVID anymore and what happened under Trump.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was actually trying to interject the exact same point that you just made, which is, I mean, that's something a lot of voters don't get because, yeah, you know, you can look back at 2017 to 2021 and say, you know, the country didn't fall apart. You know, I mean, things like, you know, Trump's Ukraine impeachment and those things were terrible, but they weren't something that affected people's day-to-day lives. And like you said, people don't realize the huge difference between then and now, which is Trump and his minions involved with Project 2025 have figured out what the difference was. And that was getting rid of the type of bureaucrats and officials who are an obstacle. And Milley's a great example. You know, if Mark Milley had not been where he was in the Pentagon, January 6th might have turned out much differently, because there was, you know, there's still unresolved questions about what Team Trump really had in mind about how to possibly use the military or the National Guard on January 6th. But whatever devious ideas they had in mind, you know, Milley was there to prevent that. So their goal now is to get the Mark Milleys of the world out of the way. And as I'm sure you reported in your reporting on Project 2025, really the central aspect of it is replacing career bureaucrats with MAGA loyalists throughout the government. So when Trump, you know, when Trump wants to court-martial a general, for example, you know, I mean, people blocked that the last time around, and people blocked Trump from having the Justice Department prosecute some of his enemies. But those people aren't going to be there. The people in the Justice Department are going to be people who are going to do whatever Trump tells them to do. And if they tell them to prosecute Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi or journalists like me and Alex, you know, they will do that, you know, and which is an authoritarian state. And it's hard to, you know, the fact that he was restrained by some decent people who were in the right positions from 2017 to 21 has made it hard to convince a certain type of voter of that argument, but it's a fact.
And since we're talking about Bob Woodward and he's doing so many interviews about his new book, War, it's important to remember that in 2020, Trump told Bob Woodward that he knew in February that COVID was, quote, deadly stuff, but wanted to play it down. And we lost 1.3 million people in this country because of COVID. Today, we're talking about the presidential election and what is at stake and media coverage. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national opinion columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic. Alex, I want to ask you about J.D. Vance and the reporting you did. But first, just a couple articles that are really important. The Guardian's got one. If Trump wins the election, U.S. cities are at risk of military takeovers and mass deportations. This came out yesterday by Ed Pilkington. Senior Democrats in U.S. cities are preparing to defend their communities in the event of Trump's return to the White House after his repeated threats that he would use presidential powers to seize control of major urban centers. Alex, do you think part of the problem, and this has come up a lot in our Project 2025 shows, is that people just think, oh, that could never happen in the United States?
Yeah, it's the classic "it can't happen here" argument, and I mean, I think that it part of the I think the thing that people are running into is not to say that all of it was illegitimate, but that a lot of Trump criticism is overhyped, and I think that in terms of what people encounter, there's not necessarily a huge differentiation between legitimate media sources. But the report from Ed Pilkington yesterday in The Guardian is very much a legitimate proposal, and it suggests that politicians, particularly Democratic politicians in major urban centers, are taking these ideas extremely seriously. And I think that they should be. And I think in general, you know, what we saw with the first Trump term, right, is that he went into office essentially having no plan at all to govern. And the people around him, or at least the people who have stuck with him, saw that as a huge drag on his ability to remake both the Republican Party and the country in his own, you know, again, authoritarian image. And that's different now. And I think that you can sort of see this in every element, right? You can think about something like using the Comstock Act to essentially ban abortion federally without any legislative action. That's in Project 2025 as well. And, you know, I think that part of the issue is that these things do seem like they come out of a novel or sort of, you know, Michael Bay movie. But these are legitimate plans. There are people that are very close to Donald Trump and even closer to J.D. Vance who are taking this kind of stuff, you know, extremely seriously. And I think there was a real push-pull in terms of you know, filling out the kind of empty spaces of Trumpism. Like there was a lot of, there's a lot of stuff that Trump doesn't care about, right? The larger ideological project is essentially you got to deport a lot of immigrants and you want to put tariffs everywhere. He doesn't understand tariffs. That's beside the point. But I think everywhere else, you know, there is a real intellectual edifice now that is, you know, cranking stuff out to get ready for a second Trump term. And I think that that just wasn't the case, right? If you look at the people that he nominated, who were Senate approved for his cabinet in the first term, like these were mostly pretty boring, you know, steadfast conservative figures who largely had experience in the Reagan era, you know, and it's not going to be the case this time. And, you know, I think that one area, to go back to the original focus of sort of media coverage, where we've struggled is how to get that across in a way that makes people take it seriously, that it's not just going to be, you know, a return to the quote unquote prosperity of 2018, that, you know, there are pretty significant attendant risks for, you know, remaking the country in numerous ways.
Sam Levin has another piece in The Guardian saying if Donald Trump wins the election, he's expected to pursue a spree of executions that could fast track the cases of people on federal death row and threaten the life of a man with a longstanding innocence claim. And we'll definitely do a show about that. I wish we had more time. We're almost out of time. So I hope everyone can read Alex's piece about J.D. Vance. The vision he has outlined for the future of the country is dark and authoritarian. I do want to end quickly, and I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, asking you both about Kamala Harris. Will, you wrote a piece about how she's spending a lot of time really reaching out to Republicans. She has spent time with Liz Cheney, talked about how Dick Cheney supports her. She says she's going to put a Republican in her cabinet, wants a bipartisan panel of policy advisors. You write, Harris has a good record on climate change, but seems more determined to play up her recent support for fracking. Progressives like Bernie Sanders are supporting her, but Harris has now held more joint rallies with Liz Cheney than with Sanders. She's also refused to suggest there's any daylight in the Middle East between her and Biden, who has alienated the Arab and Muslim communities, especially in states like Michigan. So, sorry, Will, we've got just 2 minutes left, but can you elaborate on this column?
Yeah, I'm just trying to make the point that when you choose where how you're going to emphasize your campaign, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, it's interesting. She is showing some gains with Republicans and independents because that's who she's really playing up going after. But there have been a couple of recent polls that show her support from Democrats actually ticking down a couple points. And there is this feeling among what I might call the farther left, you know, which is an important part of the Democratic base, that they're not being addressed to or spoken to. I mean, go back to the convention in Chicago when they did not allow any pro-Palestinian person to give a speech, which you know, would have mollified a lot of protesters. And we're talking about very narrow margins. You know, Hillary Clinton lost in good measure in 2016 because of people on the far left and like-minded voters who stayed home or voted for Jill Stein or voted third party. And those options exist again. And, you know, I would hate to see that same mistake being made by the Kamala Harris campaign.
Michael Moore just put out a piece and it says, my plea to Kamala, those of us in Michigan have serious concerns about you possibly losing Michigan, and we cannot let that happen. We fear you may not have the whole picture that we see here on the ground, and that's why we're reaching out to you. I mean, he writes about 200 to 300,000 Arab or Muslim Americans who live in Michigan, who've either lost ones in Gaza or live with the daily fear that their families and friends in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon are in a constant state of terror and in fear of losing their lives.
Yeah, and Will, we have 30 seconds left. Yeah, I was just gonna say really quickly, I mean, and something like the Dick Cheney endorsement, I mean, they also remember Iraq, and That doesn't help with those voters. It really doesn't.
Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. His latest book is After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics. Alex Shepard is senior editor of The New Republic, where he has covered politics and culture since 2015. Will and Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it's just important, I had to look up the numbers. When Will said Hillary Clinton lost the election, I always think about the Electoral College. So she won the popular vote, almost 66 million to Trump's almost 63 million, but did not win the Electoral College. And we often wonder why the Electoral College doesn't get more media attention, but I think it's important to always share those numbers. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.